Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast by Literal Humans. As usual, I'm one of your co-hosts, Paul David.
I'm Rebecca Hedman.
And I'm Savina Serrana.
We should mention that our guy Will is away this week. He is currently surfing in Sri Lanka, which we're very happy for him. It was a well-deserved break. He works very hard. And we'll be hopeful to have him back next week on our next episode. I should also mention he wasn't able to join us for our last episode where we talked about all things bootstrapping and VC. We missed him dearly. But this week we're focused on a recap of updates in the tech world from the past few weeks.
So to kick us off, I'm going to be talking about the Online Safety Harms Act. So this is something that the UK government is trying to introduce to protect more people online. And it's primarily aimed at protecting children, as it lays down some really interesting rules around social media content and how it's policed. Some penalties are introduced and even suggesting prison time for individual tech execs if they fail to comply with the legislation. It's interesting as well because overall in the UK, when legislation comes into power and is protecting our data, so for example GDPR, that is actually enforced by the ICO, which is the Information Commissioner Officer. This seems to have some power given to Ofcom, who regulates TV. So if there's a complaint about Love Island, you send it to Ofcom. So it looks like there's like a shift in the UK at the moment towards how we regulate online services, moving away just from purely focusing it from a data point of view and looking at it in terms of content. What's particularly interesting about the Online Safety Bill, and has been since it's been introduced, is how it's dealing with encryption. Now, a lot of conversations around encryption normally really focus on protecting children. Now, I previously worked in edtech and worked alongside 5 to 12 year olds. That is a big concern of ours when I was at the organizations, but also on a personal note, you know, how children are interacting with technology today. I think sometimes when you see children interacting with technology, it feels quite doomsday. It's like one or the other. It's either, no, this is completely bad for them, their attention span are reducing and we shouldn't be having them in screens for so long, or it's seen the other side of, you know, during COVID, this is their access to the world and this is how they're being educated, this is how they're being entertained. And sometimes for many parents, you know, it's their quiet time that they actually have and they probably deserve throughout the day. But when it comes to children's data and being shared online, that seems to be a whole nother conversation, which is elicited when it comes to the encryption conversation. So a lot of messaging services such as WhatsApp and Signal are end-to-end encrypted. And what that means is that no one outside of the conversation, the people in the conversation, can view the content. That means WhatsApp can't look at conversations and monitor them in any sort of way. Personally, I think this is a brilliant technology because it doesn't allow kind of governments to be spying on you. It doesn't require police to maybe sometimes obtain information that they shouldn't be able to obtain about you as well. But on the other hand, you have a lot of people who are fighting to protect children who say that, well, this is a backdoor to child abuse images being shared and videos circulated amongst people and it protects them. The Online Safety Bill is suggesting that the government is allowed a backdoor entry into end-to-end encryption. If you don't know how end-to-end encryption works, it is technically impossible to create a backdoor that is only accessible through one area and can't be, you know, eventually exploited by another. It's also impossible for services to only offer that in one country and not others, which is why WhatsApp and Signal are just two examples of companies who are threatening to leave the UK market if they're required to comply with these regulations. And that is quite a big move to make. And these are quite big stances that people are making across this. And it'll be interesting to see where this story goes in terms of how people fall on the whole encryption idea.
I think, Savina, you have just introduced that brilliantly. It's a really interesting topic and one that even if you don't have children, as you said, you've worked with children, so you know how important this subject is and this topic is. And it kind of digs deeper into this whole topic about encryption, end-to-end encryption. And I think even when I think about encrypted messaging services in 2019, this is where I kind of knew messaging services like WhatsApp, Snapchat, any kind of end-to-end encryption were in danger of being cracked open, because we had the EncroChat hack, which I don't know if you remember happened in 2020, where it was basically the NCA in the UK cracked open this encrypted chat line, EncroChat, which was used, I suppose, negatively, wrongly by criminals, etc. But essentially what EncroChat was, it was made for business people to communicate. Stocks, traders, and the investment industry to obviously have this encrypted services. So when this kind of cracked open in 2020, and it was this big thing, I kind of knew that this end-to-end encryption services that we had been having access to and benefiting from was in danger. And it was just a ticking time bomb for when they were in force having to crack open this encrypted messaging services. So I think now we are just seeing the long line of what has been pending for a long, long time. And going back to the online safety bill, I think it is one of those things where as a parent, I'm like, amazing. Great. And I suppose you feel the same working in edtech and seeing, you know, children using technology. You think this is great. This is perfect from that perspective. But then we have this question of privacy and breaching our data in that way. It leads to some concerns. I think for the big tech companies, we will see them push back on this quite heavily. And it makes it kind of nerve-wracking, especially as the UK has more than one issue at the moment with repelling UK tech. When we look at all the different things that they're imposing, even when we look at the way that they're treating the immigration, we've spoken about this on the pod before, and the things that make the UK not quite an attractive hub for tech, this just kind of adds to the pot. So I'm intrigued to see how this rolls out. I'm intrigued to see how it works in with compliance and all those kinds of things. But do I think it's timely? The majority of me says yes. I think, you know, we've had the internet, social media now for how many years? About over 20 years, yeah, give or take. I think the first social media was when? 1997. So there you go. Yeah. Coming up near 30 years. So I think seeing something like this just be introduced now is definitely just like, okay, they're only just thinking of online safety. It will have some negatives for big businesses, big tech, but I'm sure that there'll be workarounds. So I'm intrigued to see how it rolls out and kind of pans out and what the next step, because I always think there's an agenda with these things, what the next step in the agenda is for the government.
Yeah, you hope there's a genuine interest in like solving issues like abuse of children that is sort of, you know, being perpetrated through the use of some of these encrypted tools, and that the government's not using it as like just another excuse to like tap into everyone's privacy and target people who have nothing to do with that kind of abuse, which is, you know, there's lots of legitimate organizers, for example, activists and stuff like that, use these platforms, you know, to great benefit and deserve that protection and anonymity to some extent. And obviously, you know, folks who are abusing children do not and should be pursued, right? But yeah, I mean, you really hope that the government will apply rules and sort of regulations in terms of like when police can request that. So this very, very special exception. We already know from the reporting on the NSO group out of Israel that a backdoor exists and that there are, you know, security forces already using it, many of them against some of these very organizers and stuff like that. So we've already seen signs that the government will not be true to its word in terms of how it uses these tools. I mean, maybe we shouldn't have that much faith that they will be, but it's interesting that they're raising the specter of, you know, child abuse, which everyone agrees needs to be stopped, as a way in for this stuff. So natural suspicion arises, but they kind of put the voter in a difficult situation where you're like, you feel like you're arguing against protecting, you know, children, but arguing for your privacy, which is, you know, absolutely an absurd position and very much to the point of why they're doing it. But yeah, I mean, it's a worrisome time. You hope that they can sit down with these tech providers and figure out a way, which sounds like it's kind of happening already, to maintain privacy and protection for those who deserve to have it, which is virtually all of us, but also, you know, have the opportunity to like get the information they need when there actually is child's life on the line, for example. So I don't know if it's that stark of a distinction, but we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, I think protecting children is often kind of a use case that people brandish in different ways, yeah, like to further their own point. In the USA, it's often used to battle against sex workers as well and like reduce their rights that they have online because they feel like the crossover between pornography and child sexual abuse, like photos and trafficking, is like a big crossover. And so the kind of clampdown on sex workers in a variety of countries has been as a consequence of trying to protect children. And, you know, there's a very conservative kind of crossover there of those sort of aims as well. And I don't think it's as stark as I want to protect children or I want to have privacy. I don't think it should be like that. And I also would want to question and further, like, what are the non-technological solutions to this problem as well? And cracking open end-to-end encryption it will only get you so far, because these people unfortunately may find other ways. This was a problem that existed before this technology existed. So what are the other solutions that we can find to talk about people that make children feel safe, that they can have safe spaces to talk to people about if this is happening to them, or if they've been coerced online? Where are the safe spaces? Where's the funding for the community centers and the kind of child minders and child therapists, so that they have access to these tools that are outside of technology, that are safe, that they can talk about these problems and have awareness of what could happen and the dangers of it as well?
Yeah, I think that is such a valid point, because these measures should be the safety net. There should be the initial thing where guardians, or, you know, people who are in the care of these children, or the children who are in the care of these people, should really be the first point of call. And that, we know the saying, it takes a community, it takes a village. And I think that there should be a lot of education around online safety, and that would be a great place to start if the main concern is obviously child protection, which it should be. So I really agree with you on that as well. And then I think we fall into this nasty rabbit hole of, where does it end? We've seen nations that prohibit different messaging, different social media apps. We all know about some really famous ones, which I won't mention on the pod for fear, sheer fear and terror. But, you know, there are nations out there that don't allow their population to have freedom when it comes to using apps and using online websites, etc. And I think if we allow this kind of breach or these things to kind of snowball on and continue, where do we draw the line? Will we in 10, 20 years be looking at a nation here in Britain where we are only allowed to use X, Y, and Z, and we have to stick to that? And then, you know, that raises some other concerns as well. So I think this online safety bill passing definitely sparks some really interesting conversation and debate that I'm intrigued to see play out, but nervous as well, not gonna lie.
I don't think it's passed yet.
Has it not passed
yet? No, I think it's due to pass this autumn. Yeah, so watch this space.
Watch this. We will be reporting on this.
Yes.
Live. We're going to go to the House of Commons.
That would be great.
Yeah. Last point on that is just interesting to see. I think we're like moving to this era where like different countries and regions are passing different forms of regulation. Obviously, the U.S. continues to be the freaking wild, wild west when it comes to this stuff. Anything goes as usual. But, you know, obviously the EU has stepped in with GDPR, and now the U.K. is kind of creating its own sort of lane. And obviously you see what's happening in places like China, where they have WeChat and like a whole different framework and stuff like that, the Great Firewall, all that stuff. So you're starting to see this like balkanization of the internet and different user experiences in different places and stuff like that. So I think like watch that as like an interesting trend of like how the internet is being sort of sliced and diced, and people in different countries, fortunately, unfortunately, are having different experiences of what it is and what it means. So something to look out for. And I think there's some good in that, is that we can start to see, like, you could argue GDPR is like a good, and like it's because the EU is such a large market, it's sort of setting the tone for other markets to increase their focus on privacy and protection of data and things like that. So we're hopeful that like the cream will rise to the top, as it were, of like the best regulations. You know, other countries will start to adopt them and take them as sort of something to aspire to.
We've got an interesting one for topic two here. Amazon AI reviews. So Amazon serves as the go-to destination for most people. I mean, we've all ordered something off Amazon and got it next day, Prime. But they have just introduced this month AI reviews. So the company revealed a fresh innovation. It basically is AI-generated review summaries. It's a feature that automatically crafts and presents a concise summary of custom reviews. But as with any advancement, you have to wonder what could possibly go wrong with that. I mean, it's a difficult one. Sabina, I see you are an Amazon girly. No.
But I have a low stakes conspiracy theory about this.
Nice. Oh, let's
see. When ChatGPT obviously still on the rise, a lot of, I think, small business owners started to generate AI-generated reviews. And this was reported on in like around quarter one this year. And so if you Googled AI reviews Amazon, all the news articles were about how people were generating AI reviews. So weren't from real people. Today, if you Googled it, it would be about how Amazon are using AI to summarize their reviews. So they've kind of completely changed the trajectory of what that Google search looks like by introducing this new feature. And so part of me is a bit cynical that they're trying to move the conversation away from the use of generative AI to produce reviews which are false, and move it towards, look at us, we're doing some really interesting work with AI to make it easier for the consumer. and how much are they actually doing to address fake reviews? So that was my first thoughts.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think we want to see in the evidence like how this actually prevents or gets underneath sort of the persistent problem of fraudulent customer reviews, which I think is like an important problem. And like, if you're thinking of a platform like Amazon as like a place where you go to understand and buy like trusted products, like those reviews are really important. How do we tackle both fraudulent AI and human reviews, I think would be maybe a more interesting question. And yeah, it's super interesting. I think we're pretty conspiracy curious on Tech Can't Save Us, or we're open to. No, but I mean, like, I think companies do that all the time. Like, let's roll out a product to kind of shade some stuff that we're doing here that's maybe not super great for the consumer, but is great for the company. So I think it's an important perspective. And yeah, I mean, I think we shouldn't take all AI as like a net positive. Like, I think obviously, as we're seeing, and I think that's a really good flag for this bit with Amazon.
I think it's really interesting as well, the way that they're going to present this feature. So it says here that the new feature presents as a concise paragraph on the product detail page, highlighting the product features and frequently mentioned customer sentiments from reviews. So from my understanding, how would you AI generate those things? Because surely they need to be truly authentic. They can't just be something that is made up. And they're saying here that they are going to address the fake reviews, but how will they be able to do that? I don't understand how this feature is going to be working. So I think that's where my confusion comes in.
Yeah, it sounds like they've said that they're going to use only trusted reviews from verified purchases, which is interesting, because I often think about that too. I'm like, as I'm reading these reviews, how do I know that this person has actually bought the product and used it, you know, the right way, and that they're saying truthful things about their experience with the product? So I think that could be really interesting if they're able to gather up verifiable, high quality reviews and then give you a summary based on that. Like, I could see that as like a net positive for the consumer, but that goes into like, you know, how do they determine what a trusted review is and a verified purchase and that a customer has used it well. And so again, we're in this world of like, I hope the algorithm is working the way it should be, which we're constantly talking about with AI and just a lot of things. But if it does what they say it does, then, you know, I'm hopeful that'll provide a net positive. But also it could be, you know, a way of just like, you know, potentially shading actual problems that are happening with products that, you know, people need to be aware of. I always wondered about that with reviews too. Like, I feel like it's always Amazon's benefit to give positive reviews for almost every product because they want people buying more things. So like, I'm always like, God damn, like, how do I know this is actual, you know, good stuff? But I mean, you still see negative reviews on there and sort of critiques of products. So
I think the art of writing a good review is fascinating because like the emotion behind writing a review is always at the extremes. You're never going to write a review for something that's mediocre. I write a review because I had a great time, I read a great book, or I really enjoyed the Airbnb, or it was awful. Do not do this. I deter you. This will be the worst decision of your life. And so, yeah, just the function of like reviewing things online is always quite an interesting process for me. I like, I recently went to an Airbnb and left them a little review, and they left me a review. And it felt like a really weird exchange where I was so polite, that way more polite than I ever would be in my life. And so, yeah, trying to summarize that through an AI, I'm like, I don't know if they were able to pick up on all the nuances that you do when you scan something and you're able with your human eyes to be able to pick up on some, maybe some sarcasm, maybe like an in-joke about the area.
Airbnb is the one platform where I care so much about my reviews. Like, I'm just obsessed with having good reviews on Airbnb because it's like, you're in people's homes. You're a guest, and like, people will read that about you and you want to get into other homes and stuff like that.
What about your Uber rating?
I'm okay. Well, the problem is like, I'm often the one when I'm out with friends, like, order the Uber, and then there's a bunch of, I'll just say it, drunk idiots in the car, and then my rating goes down. I think I'm at like a 4.76, which I'm like happy
with.
That's
actually quite good, Paul.
I think what the podcast is at.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's all right. But yeah, I mean, I care about my Uber rating, but yeah, we'll see.
I think as well with Amazon, you might start to see their competitors really adopt this as well, which makes me kind of nervous, because when I think about AI generated reviews on Amazon, it's like, okay, fine. But when you maybe think about it on a different platform, for example, I don't even know, let's say Facebook Marketplace, you really start to get worried, because it's like, you don't want an AI generated review there. That is where you need complete and utter honesty, especially when you're dealing with pre-loved goods or, you know, vintage goods. I spoke earlier on our team call about listing my things on Vinted. Now, that platform thrives off honesty. It is based on the truth. So an AI generated review for a platform such as Vinted or Depop wouldn't work in the same way. So I think it makes me a little bit nervous in case these companies do try to copy this formula from Amazon. What will be the outcome of that? I don't know. Will it change the whole shopping experience completely? It's a wild one.
Yeah, I'm glad you shouted out Vinted. We should get them on the show, by the way. Yes. So let's shout out to, I think they're based in, where are they based? In Vilnius? What country is that?
Don't know, but love that for them.
Yeah,
hold on,
great.
Hold on. I'm going to do a quick little search here. We got the Lithuania.
Wait,
so,
shout out.
I don't know if we've had any guests from Lithuania on the show yet. But anyway, one thing I wanted to shout out about this Amazon thing is the pre-generated keywords for the summaries. I think that is really interesting because like I often go and I'm looking for specific product attributes. I do this a lot when I'm looking for a restaurant. I'm like, okay, I don't want to hear about your whole restaurant. Mm. Are you good for brunch? You know, or like some specific facet of it. So if there are pre-generated keywords that allow me to search based on the thing I'm looking for, or if there's a mechanism to kind of like, I only want to hear about brunch, or I only want to hear about your vegan options, or whatever, I think that would be super useful for the customer. And if they're based on verifiable quality reviews, then great.
But then are you going to start getting jobs where you are a reviewer trying to essentially do like SEO optimization for your review, but that's like not SEO optimized, but AI optimized, so that you basically fit into the kind of rankings of how that algorithm is writing its summary as well?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting terrain. We may even start getting into that in terms of like trying to help our customers rank within AI, you know, responses. Like, I mean, it's a total, again, Wild Wild West area right now, but like that's going to start to happen, as, and we should maybe do a show on this, is like the rise of Google snippets and like zero click searches and basically like dark search and all this stuff that's coming out, where like people aren't going to navigate to that first organic result, which is our whole job, is getting people to rank, you know, on Google. And they're going to have these other pathways to get the information that they need without having to rank organically. So it's something that's like really about in GA4. It's like really shaking up the world of search and something we got to think about a lot more. But yeah, it's a really good point. Like people, whatever the system is, people will start to optimize for it. So like get ready for people to game whatever system is there. So it's a really good point, Sabina. Next topic today, we're going to talk about one that's near and dear to my heart, which is the space race. So I don't know if folks know, but we're actually in the middle of another space race right now, and it involves the moon, which is super awesome. So the thing with the moon here is essentially that there's a race to get to the south pole of the moon, because there's the belief that there are water resources there. And if there are water resources there, then we can essentially use those water resources to convert it into air, convert it into rocket fuel and things like that. And so no country has yet landed successfully on the south pole of the moon. Russia was meant to do it last week, but unfortunately their unmanned robot lander crashed after it spun out of control. So another unfortunate L for Russia there.
Damn.
sorry. They're just taking a lot of L's lately, as they should in many ways. But I will say that it's exciting that like we're starting to see this race ramp up. They were racing against India, which is slated to launch its lunar lander, the Chandrayaan 3. I don't know if I said that correctly. Fix me there. But it's been an interesting sort of race because Russia obviously is trying to prove itself as a space superpower. And obviously they're a bit distracted by the aggression against Ukraine, unfortunately. And yeah, I mean, maybe that contributed to this crash. They had the most Orwellian statement from Roscosmos, which is their NASA, I guess. They said, "The apparatus moved into an unpredictable orbit and ceased to exist as a result of a collision with the surface of the moon." Like, that statement alone.
Ceased to exist.
Yeah, like, ceased to exist, and it collided with the surface. Yeah, no shit, it collided with the surface of the moon. Anyway, that was a hilarious statement. So yeah, that's the latest and the greatest with the Luna 25 spacecraft on the Russia side. On the other side of it, India's announced that their lander is just days from touching down, just as the Russian craft crashes or collides with the surface of the moon, as the Russians said. So their space agency, ISRO, said in a social media post that, and ironically this came just minutes after Russia announced the destruction of its craft, that it hopes to land its Vikram robotic lander on Wednesday of, it'll be last week by the time this airs. But it's exciting because they are set to basically break ground on landing on the lunar south pole and getting samples and getting understanding of, is there really, you know, water in that portion of the moon? They're going to run tests on the composition of the moon's surface. They're going to measure seismic activity, look at temperature and radiation levels. So yeah, it's a very exciting time for the race to the moon. I'm very excited about it, as you all can hear. And yeah, it could mean the advent of colonizing the moon, which is very exciting.
And something that people here on Earth love to do, colonize places. So love that. Love it for
hopefully we can start to take better care of people on Earth from some products that are developed on the moon base. It's probably going to just be a mining fiasco, or the mining companies go there and just like pillage the moon. But, you know, hopefully we can learn our lessons from history and do a better job. But
yeah, I think with the space race, what was so exciting about it from looking back at what it was able to achieve is all the other inventions that were created because of it. Like the Humble Pencil was like a crazy, amazing invention that is used and taken for granted every day. It was because of the huge investment that goes into trying to essentially colonize space. And so, you know, with the advancement of these two nations as they're trying to create these amazing vehicles to be able to take them up to space and explore what Pink Floyd tried to talk about for a long time, it's going to be really interesting to see how this technology is utilized in all sorts of other ways and what other inventions it's going to give rise to.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that, Savina, because we actually talked about a few episodes ago there being a 3D printer which prints pizza, actual pizza. And this is an invention by NASA. So this was a space-inspired invention. So you're right, it really is inspiring a lot of different technology to be created, things that you wouldn't have even thought would come from spacecraft. So I'm interested to see as well what else gets made and developed. But I think it's really interesting, this story, how India waited until Russia sent Luna 25 up to test. And then, you know, as soon as it didn't work, India was like, yeah, we will be launching ours in a few days. So love that for India. What a win. Want to see their spacecraft, you know, make it all the way to the South Pole of the moon. And yeah, we'll be reporting here live and direct.
I love that they just tweeted it.
Yeah.
They were like, this global news story, which, you know, many Russian scientists have been stressing over. And they're like, yeah, we can fit this under 280 characters. Yeah. We can do that. Thanks for wishes and positivity as part of their tweet. I love it so much. The pettiness. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Excellent move.
Yeah, I think some of the less moving away from the pettiness, but some of the science behind the lunar landing, like the idea that, you know, it's a big problem transporting like heavy machinery because of Earth's gravitational pull. It takes a lot of rocket fuel and just, you know, like energy to successfully get that stuff up there. So if we can build that stuff on the moon, then that just makes it a bit easier. Also this idea that certain parts of the moon are illuminated for large portions of the year. So I think there's like something like 200 days of constant illumination on that part of certain parts of the moon. So that means solar power is another resource that can be used up there. So that could lead to major advancements in solar power. It could be an energy source for people back on Earth if we're able to kind of beam or transmit that energy back to Earth, which would be really interesting. So there's some like really cool potential, you know, scientific advancements that new station or encampment would sort of lead to, which I think are really exciting from this mission here.
Yeah, and I think in the development of those, it'd be really interesting to see how IP laws might have to change as we go outside of Earth. You know, what does it mean to own a piece of technology which doesn't exist on Earth? How is that even regulated and copyrighted? Like, things could really change and like advance a lot of interesting conversations.
Fun fact about the moon, it's moving away from us at a slow pace every single year. So obviously that changes like the gravitational pull it has on the Earth and different things like tides and even the Earth's like rotation and magnetic field and stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, this is happening over billions of years, but it's still a trend that's happening and something that, you know, scientists have to take into account as they're building models to like reach the moon and understand its effect on like our weather patterns, for example. It's also, you know, worth noting that there's other missions that are preparing to go to the moon. Japan is preparing to send a smart lander on August 26th, which is like just a small scale mission to collect some data and practice accurate lunar landing techniques. And they also have a small explorer. And of course, NASA's new Artemis program, they've just debuted the most diverse class of astronauts we've ever seen, fortunately, and special spacesuits that actually fit women. And they figured out that problem, women's bodies, and how to give them spacesuits, which is absolutely absurd, but they did it. Great. But they're looking to put humans back on the moon in a series of space flights more than half a century after the Apollo missions. So yeah, it's an exciting time for the moon. This quote from the BBC, the moon is still surprising us, is great. I mean, I think that we look up to the heavenly skies at night, and now we can, you know, hopefully use the moon as a place to grow our humanity.
That's so sweet.
I'm a space optimist.
that's fair enough. Yeah.
It would be nice to see us come kind of full circle on that Apollo, isn't it? Just to get somebody else up into the moon. I'm here for it.
As it slowly drifts away from
us. I know,
yeah,
yeah. Running away
there's
from
some
us.
Really like romantic tension there, isn't there?
Yes, yeah. There is. Yes, there is. Also gets excited too. I mean, if you think further, like, eventually we'll go to Mars. And so the moon is an important jumping off point, because a lot of times they talk about we'll need to send a ship to the moon to, like, you know, restock. And it's obviously a shorter trip, or so it's easier to run that mission if you have a base on the moon. So that's very exciting. I hope that NASA learns its lesson and make sure that the first person on the moon is ideally a woman, maybe a woman of color. And, you know, we can sort of undo the wrongs of the Apollo program of just landing white men on the moon. But yeah, it's looking good for the Artemis program so far. So we'll see what happens there.
Going to rise so many more conspiracy theories, though.
Yeah, probably.
That's like my first thought of that as well. Like, oh yeah, what happened with Man on the Moon? It was just a bunch of skeptics, and now all the skeptics can find each other online.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting.
We'll just have to live stream it really well so that they can, they can pick apart the live stream and have a million YouTube videos dissecting how the live stream was faked and all that stuff. So yeah, that's how that goes.
So we delved into the online safety bill, Amazon's AI-generated review system, and the competition between Russia and India to develop functional spacecraft prototypes. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Tech Can't Save Us.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, then please be sure to like, subscribe, and share the pod.
And for you folks out there listening, we put together a very quick survey. We're getting into more audience engagement, so we'd love to hear from you. That survey is located in our episode description and would really help us out. Just take a few minutes to please head over and give us your insights. We want to hear from you what topics we should cover, potential guests we can have on, and just any other bits of advice you have for us. We want this to be your tech podcast where you learn new things and gain new insights. So as always, you can reach us at podcast@literalhumans.com with thoughts and feedback on today's and any episode. Catch you next time.